Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
Today on Valley Edition, we look at an investigation into jail inmate deaths in California. The sharpest increases are in Fresno County.
Also in Fresno County, the huge number of liquor licenses. Some city council members have proposed an ordinance to limit them. And we get an update on Valley fever cases in Kern County and learn about a national program importing reporters into local places.
But first, as part of our ongoing series about the opioid crisis called In Recovery, we take you to the front lines of drug enforcement. FM89's Carrie Klein spends a day with the Bakersfield Police Department and learns they're battling much more than opioids.
4243.
Christian Hernandez has been a Bakersfield cop since 2013. The job has its moments.
We'll find narcotics in their pockets, and they'll say that the pants that they're wearing are not theirs.
And you get that a lot?
I've gotten it at least 10 times that I can think of.
It's late afternoon, and Hernandez just began a patrol shift with his partner, Jaime Orozco. They're officers with the city's gang unit. In the back seat, where I am, is a black metal rack.
It usually occupies an AR-15 and a shotgun.
In addition to guns, batons, body cams, they carry around a laptop in an armored case. When they look up IDs and license plates, it makes goofy video game sounds, but it looks serious, like what I'd imagine Cold War spies would swap under park benches. You guys are in the gang unit. I mean, how often do drugs come up in that unit?
A lot.
A lot. Yeah. Like, just going back, it's an origin, you know, it almost starts with narcotics.
Take the Plaza Motel at Union and 8th, a single-story complex of white rooms all facing onto a central parking lot.
These little hotels here, this is all, like, infiltrated with a lot of drug use.
A bunch of people sit on folding chairs outside a motel room. The cops know one guy, he's on parole, and his buddies drinking a beer in public. The guy on parole, we'll call him H, is the one renting the room, which means the officers can search it without a warrant. Orozco radios for backup, and four more officers arrive in minutes.
Nathan, can you help me real quick?
Among those is Nathan Poteet, who puts on gloves and scours the room, lifting the TV, flipping the mattress. There's nothing unexpected until they pick up a cell phone case on a dresser to reveal a narrow line of white crystals, almost like sugar.
Well, there's some dope right there. That's crystal.
How can you tell it's meth?
Like, see how it's got like a crystal?
A lot coarser than cocaine would be.
Yeah, it's not very... Well, and even sometimes, this is broken up pretty well, but sometimes there'll be bigger crystals.
While his partner scrapes the line into a plastic bag, Poteet walks outside to grill H, who's sitting on the curb with his buddies.
Yeah, the right to my side, they're set.
A few women sit nearby with toddlers and a baby. H identifies himself, says he snorts meth about once a week. He started using when he was 12.
But if there were 100 people, how many would you think use meth staying at this hotel?
Out of 100 people here, H estimates around 70 are using meth, maybe 80. But it's not a surprisingly high number to these cops. Meth's a factor in around 4 of every 10 drug incidents in Bakersfield. It's the most common reason patients seek drug treatment from the county. Poteet cuffs H, then takes him off to county jail. But back in the patrol car, Jaime Orozco tells me H won't be there for long because he wasn't selling the meth.
That's the only time that ever becomes a felony anymore.
That's thanks to Proposition 47, which in 2014 downgraded most drug possessions from a felony to a misdemeanor. Cops tell me this has led to more drugs on the street, which data from the county sheriff's office generally confirms. But Orozco says Prop 47 has had another surprising effect, calmer interactions with suspects.
It's shocking because when I first started, it was all a felony, so they would run and car pursuits, vehicle pursuits. Yeah, it was crazy.
That was in 2013, but now...
There's no real reason to run anymore. You know, it's just, they know they're going to get out in a few hours. It'll just be like a 16-hour hold at the jail, and then they'll be right back out.
But even H's short jail stint means officers need to catalog his belongings. Next stop, the police property room and lab. While Orozco dumps out candy and spare change from H's backpack, then puts it in a locker, Christian Hernandez tests H's drugs. He scoops a minuscule sample of the crystals into a glass vial, stirs, and waits for a reaction.
You can see it turned orange, which tests positive per the kit.
It's officially methamphetamine. Hernandez seals the bag and hands it over as evidence. Eventually, it'll be destroyed. Central California is a conduit for meth. According to the Drug Enforcement Agency, the majority of it comes in through the border with Mexico. It's cheaper than it used to be, and seizures at the border have been creeping up for years. But as Orozco and Hernandez get back in their patrol car, they tell me meth isn't the only drug worrying law enforcement.
Have you ever seen fentanyl in the streets?
I don't think
it's powdery like cocaine, but...
I think we've seen it only during search warrants. Yeah.
Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid some 50 times as potent as heroin. It hasn't yet devastated California the way it has the East Coast, but the feds are seizing more and more of it throughout the country, a lot in deadly combination with other drugs. But even if Hernandez had come across fentanyl, he'd have likely called in the narcotics team, which is trained to handle fentanyl carefully, sometimes in full-body hazmat suits.
A small dose, if we were to get into contact with that, with no gloves or anything, it could be very lethal.
Thanks to opioids, some officers have even become makeshift health providers, administering the overdose recovery drug naloxone. Most Bakersfield cops don't carry it, but the county sheriff's office has used naloxone at least 11 times since 2016.
We call this District 3, and it's basically the West Side Crip territory. So
toward the end of the evening, I switch cars and ride with Nathan Poteet and his partner. It feels to me like they deal with the same offenses and the same offenders over and over. It reminds me of a certain Greek myth.
I mean, are you familiar with, like, Sisyphus? Like, what is that, Greek myth or Roman?
I thought you were talking syphilis.
No.
I know of it.
Not syphilis, but Sisyphus, a disgraced king who gets sentenced to rolling a boulder uphill again and again for eternity.
Are you talking about, like, we're not getting anywhere by arresting him?
Or just, maybe.
As far as drug users go, like when I was in patrol, absolutely, you run into the same person who's a problem over and over and over again.
Then again, Poteet says, most people don't last long using heavy drugs. Eventually, they do disappear, and the cycle starts again. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This story was supported by a data journalism fellowship from the USC Center for Health Journalism.
In most places in California, there's a liquor store for about every 2,500 people. But in the city of Fresno, it's way more than double. One liquor store for every 1,000 residents. And nearly half of the liquor stores selling alcohol are in violation of city or state laws. That's according to a recent investigation. While residents have complained about the high concentration of liquor stores for years, FM89's Laura Satsui reports, some council members are finally taking a stand.
Fresno City Council member Miguel Arias opens up a plastic bag that's been sitting on his office desk.
These are King Cobra's malt liquor, 24 ounces, being sold at a cheaper price than a bottle of water.
He bought them at a convenience store near a school in his district, which includes Southwest Fresno.
How much is that?
89 cents. So it's going for the bottle of water costs you $1.30.
Last month, the city conducted an investigation on about half of the city's liquor stores.
Of the 460 current license holders, we inspected 204. 96% of them failed the inspection.
There were over 900 violations. Some stores lacked signs about the legal drinking age, and some had too many ads covering their windows.
Unfortunately for our city, for about 30 years, we've been saying that any liquor store is a job creator, and therefore we should approve it.
One reason why Fresno's liquor licenses are more than double the state's average.
And in my neighborhoods, it's one for every 500 residents. I literally have 37 liquor stores within a mile radius of our high schools.
To address the oversaturation and lack of compliance, Arias and council members Nelson Esparza and Luis Chavez are co-sponsoring a resolution it would call for regular inspections in existing stores and more stringent requirements for developers who want to build a store with a liquor license for off-site consumption. They're calling it the Responsible Neighborhood Market Ordinance. Here's how it might work. If someone wants to open a new liquor store, they would have to get their license from an existing store within the city. The idea is that licenses would be purchased from highly concentrated areas first. Arias says this is a better option than forcing closures.
This ensures that existing businesses don't get automatically shut down, you know, when they've been doing their work and operating in good standing.
If the city right now enforced everything that they currently have on the books, I think that we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in.
That's Esther Delahay. She's the executive director of the Lowell Community Development Corporation. Last year, the Lowell CDC sued the city of Fresno for approving the development of a Johnny Quick at Van Ness and Belmont. It's in construction, even while the lawsuit is ongoing. Delahay lives nearby in the Lowell neighborhood, so she got a notice about it when the permit for the store was up for a vote. She tried to advocate against it, citing the city's own municipal code. The location is near a park and a methadone clinic, and is also blocks away from three other liquor stores.
Across the street here, this Fast and Save is a liquor store. There's a little one kind of tucked away half a block away in a little building there.
Kyle Lopez-Schmidt is walking along Belmont near Van Ness. He also opposed the project's liquor license when he was on the Tower District Design Review Committee.
And then half a block this way past this church, there's another that's by the San Pablo Park underneath the freeway.
Lopez-Schmidt doesn't think it's a coincidence that Councilmember Esmeralda Soria's campaign received a $4,400 donation from the developer of Johnny Quick days after its permit was approved last year.
Like with this situation, the developers that have more political influence, the ones that are more capitalized and have the ability to donate to city council campaigns, they're the ones that are going to get continued approval.
Soria didn't respond to a request for comment regarding the campaign donation and her vote in favor of the permit. But there was only one council member who did oppose it, the now termed out Clint Olivier. Lopez-Schmidt likes the proposed council resolution.
It's, you know, past time that we do that. Each of these projects have been removed, you know, kind of reviewed at an incremental level. And so this one by one of looking at the merits of one liquor store or another, we've continued to concentrate liquor stores.
Esther Delahay also applauds the council members for proposing the resolution, but she's cautiously optimistic.
It really depends on the budget that kind of like comes in afterwards, because if it isn't enforced or there isn't the budget to enforce it, then again, it's another really well-intentioned law with no backing.
The resolution was supposed to be heard at the city council meeting last week, but small business owners urged the council to postpone the vote. They said that they wanted more time to review the policy. It's now set to be heard at a special meeting Wednesday afternoon instead. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
Since we last reported on the sexual assault accusations against a Kern High School District employee, Edwin Rodriguez, two more lawsuits have been filed. The 40-year-old former athletic equipment manager at North High School in Bakersfield was already named in two other lawsuits. Attorney David Cohn says the most recent lawsuits claim the district knew about the assaults, but did nothing.
These are not what I would call isolated or one-off events. Rodriguez clearly had a pattern of trying to groom these young women by befriending them, by offering them sodas, candy, driving them around a golf cart.
Cohn says both women filing the recent lawsuits are former North High students. According to the lawsuits, Rodriguez would make sexual comments about their bodies and what they wore. He also asked them for sexual favors.
One of the most egregious things he seemed to have gotten away with was he would pull them out of class you have to ask yourself, how is it that an equipment manager, he's not a coach, he's not a teacher, is able to pull a student out of class?
Cone says more than 10 other students have similar stories. He says someone must have noticed Rodriguez's pattern of clearing absences for students.
Some of the school administrators, they felt uncomfortable with Rodriguez to some extent. They were somewhat uncertain as to his interaction with these young women.
But officials at the Kern High School District say they can't comment on pending litigation. According to booking records, Rodriguez is in custody and his bond is set at $175,000. His attorney did not respond to a request for comment. Nick Lackey is the deputy district attorney prosecuting the case. He won't talk about specific details, but says all the charges against Rodriguez occurred between 2015 and October 2018. His next hearing is set for July 16th. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
And now, we're going to share two stories about senior citizens, produced for the statewide California Dream Collaborative. First, we're going back to school. Across the state, there are around 134,000 public college students over the age of 50. KQED's Vanessa Roncagno takes us to Fresno to meet a man who's hitting the books again after 42 years. In 1974, Wade Hedrick was 20 years old, and he just started school at Fresno State. It only cost around $150 a year back then, and Wade's parents covered it. But he was more interested in fraternity life than his business major.
I was totally unmotivated. I didn't enjoy what I was taking. I just took it because my dad said it was a good major. I hated it.
Wade wanted to get to work and start making money.
I always thought I was going to end up selling something. And then someone said, you should sell cars. You'd be really good at it.
So when Wade got a job at a Chevrolet dealership just a couple blocks from campus, it was a matter of weeks before he dropped out of school.
Wade Hendrick to the showroom. Customer waiting.
42 years later, Wade still works at that dealership.
The warranty is 336 bumper to bumper.
He's sold some 4,000 cars over the years and has a big diamond-studded ring from General Motors to prove it.
So you're all set. The keys are in it.
He says dropping out didn't hurt his career. He owned a house and a car by the time he was 24. He married his college girlfriend, had kids, watched them grow up and become successful. But something always bugged him.
See, my brother graduated. My wife did. Two of my kids have. And, like, I didn't. I didn't finish college. I'm the only one of my family that didn't. And it really bothered me for a long time.
He dreaded having to fill out forms that asked about his level of education. So at 66 years old, Wade is back at Fresno State.
That's the student union. It was here when I was here before. There's the bookstore.
It's hardly costing him anything, thanks to a special California State University program few people have ever heard of. It gives Californians 60 and over a chance to go to some CSUs and get a degree without paying tuition or most other fees. Wade doesn't get to sign up for classes until regular students have, but he only pays $7 a semester. This time around, he's taking school seriously.
I'm not a little kid anymore.
He's majoring in communications, and he's learning about all kinds of stuff.
I wrote a paper on Asians in Hollywood, how they're represented unfavorably.
He watched Birth of a Nation and learned about GMOs.
Holland was very anti-Semitic. I would have never thought that.
He's seen three different versions of Jesus Christ Superstar.
Learned about how global warming is not a hoax. My eyes have been opened up. People that don't look like me, dress like me, doesn't mean they're not good. My whole attitude about stuff's changed. I thought you went to college to get a better job. You go to college to become a better person. I didn't get the personal growth part.
On campus, Wade gets mistaken for a professor. He jokes he could be most students' grandfather. It was scary to be back at first, but he's embraced student life. He's not doing this because he wants another career.
I will be self-satisfied that I finished.
Got it.
And stuck it out and accomplished it, and I'll die a smart guy.
He's planning a killer graduation party built around the diploma he expects to get in 2020.
And I'm going to have my degree on the table. It's going to be like a shrine.
He already knows where he's going to hang it. In Fresno, I'm Vanessa Roncagno.
And as more seniors are returning to school, the average age of California farmers has climbed to 59, according to the USDA's latest census. As this generational wave of farmers age out of the fields, they face big decisions about whether to sell the farm, pass the business on to family members, or find an alternative path. Capital Public Radio's Julia Mitrich brings us the story of a farming couple who found a way to strike a balance.
There's really no blueprint for becoming a small-scale farmer in California. Kristen Leach came into it because she got interested in traditional Korean farming.
When I started my farm, it wasn't because I felt like a competent business person or had any even basic financial literacy as an individual.
Growing veggies was just a side hustle, driven by her curiosity and work ethic. Now, Leach actually makes a living growing heirloom Korean beans, herbs, and melons for an upscale San Francisco restaurant.
So it's sort of been like accidental business owner.
That's the case for a lot of beginners, says Evan Wigg of the California Alliance with Family Farmers. The nonprofit advocacy group runs training and networking for new farmers.
We see farmers over and over again coming with a passion and interest and knowledge in crop production, in working with soil health management, and really that's usually what draws new people to agriculture.
Being outside, getting dirt under their nails, not the prospect of sitting behind a computer.
Filling out spreadsheets and crop planning and developing markets.
In California, land close to markets like San Francisco has become harder to come by and more expensive. And when small farms fail, Wigg says,
it's almost always comes down to some element of business planning. It might be a matter of cash flow.
Tracking cash flow. It's like a mantra for David Mancera, who coaches first-generation farmers to develop their business mindset.
We tend to focus on farmers who have been farming at least on their own 2 to 3 years.
Mancera is part of the Kitchen Table Advisors, a nonprofit that works with small organic farmers and ranchers in Northern California and the Central Coast. Many of his clients have gone from farm worker to farm owner. He's driving over to see one of them, Berta Magaña.
Berta. Señora Berta, buenas tardes.
As rain clouds gather, Magaña has her eye on a small farm crew moving along a row of strawberry plants. Mancera asks, how's the harvest going?
Ahorita ya se terminó prácticamente por la lluvia.
She says it's the last strawberry harvest because of the rain. It's a better yield than last season.
No pude cosechar por dos razones. Una, que mi esposo se enfermó del corazón.
Last year, Magaña's husband and farming partner had open-heart surgery. She couldn't harvest. It was a crisis. Advisor David Mancera says they'd been working on a cash flow spreadsheet. That let the bank see she was tracking money in and money out, and she had a plan going forward.
We don't tell them what to do. We guide them. We help them ask questions. Ultimately, they're the business owners. And so we're trying to help them develop this business mindset.
Winters farmer Kristen Leach also gets coaching from a Kitchen Table Advisor. She said the connection has helped her scale up her business and expand seed production.
For a lot of farmers, like, that's just such a huge boost to just not feel alone in it or have people that are kind of advocating for you and can provide resources of one kind or another.
Leach says she's still learning from her advisor. She no longer runs her farm paycheck to paycheck, but she also admits she's still stubborn enough to farm her own way. In Sacramento, I'm Julia Mitrich.
Coming up, we hear from three journalists who looked into why inmate deaths have been rising in the Fresno County Jail. We also get an update on local cases of the fungal disease Valley Fever. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
This is Barry Bennett, the Vintner Coordinator for Valley Public Radio's Wine Tasting, and I'm really excited about the wines we're going to have for you on Sunday, May 5th. Quite an assortment, some of the new wines, some that you've never heard of, an expanded variety of wines for people to try, and some of your old favorites. We'll have catering by the Elbow Room and live music from Eva Scow. Purchase tickets now at kvpr.org.
In 2011, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered California to reduce its overcrowded prisons. Sweeping reforms called realignment shifted the responsibility for thousands of inmates to county jails. Since then, there's been a sharp rise in jail inmate deaths, most notably in Fresno County. I spoke with reporters Jason Pohl of the Sacramento Bee and Ryan Gabrielson of ProPublica about their investigative series called Overcorrection. Jason Pohl starts by comparing the 7 years before and after realignment.
The dynamics inside Fresno County's jail have long been the subject of criticism. There's been some issues that have been there for a couple decades. But what's happened inside in the past 7 years is the number of deaths have basically doubled compared to the same time frame 7 years before realignment. So what that translates to is, as our reporting kind of shows, a more volatile situation with correctional officers that in many cases seem to be either outmatched or understaffed and unable to perform some of the basic duties that correctional officers are expected to perform.
And Jason, one of the characters, Ernest Brock, his story was really heartbreaking. Well, all three of them are, but this one in particular really struck me. Could you tell us about that, about him?
Sure. So Ernest Brock had initially been arrested in 2017, but the prosecutors didn't file charges in time, and so he was ultimately released. His mother told us that, as she understood it and as Mr. Brock understood it, everything was fine. One day in January 2018, however, the sheriff's office showed up at his house and arrested him for the same allegations that they had back the year prior. Well, fast forward about 24 hours or so, he ends up having a conversation from inside the jail with his mother, saying that he was concerned for his safety. He thought that his cellmate, who was acting erratically and apparently smashing his head against the wall and just being very frightening, he was worried that this cellmate might attack him. Well, his mother, throughout the night, worried about him and checked the online registry to see if he'd been moved. She had told him to request a different cellmate if he got too concerned. Well, finally, she ended up seeing that her son had been moved, but it was to the hospital. So she frantically the next day goes down to the jail and tries to get information, and ultimately she ends up at the hospital in Fresno where her son is in a coma, and it turns out that he had been strangled, allegedly by a cellmate.
Who was psychotic.
That's right.
And had not been taking his medication, correct?
One of the features, that's correct, this is Ryan. One of the features of the Fresno County Jail is not only that it's, you know, sort of crowded to the max, is that Fresno County produces one of the highest rates of people needing referral or to be transferred to the state mental hospitals. And there, at the time that this was all happening, the wait list statewide was 1,000 people. So this person who became Ernest Brock's cellmate, at least a month before, had been ordered transferred to a secure facility where they could forcibly medicate him. Without medication, in a very unpleasant environment inside the county jail, he had devolved into a pretty severe state of psychosis, clearly. Regardless, the jail did not segregate him, did not isolate him to keep other people safe from him, and clearly didn't seem to be even keeping him safe for himself, and exposed, you know, Ernest Brock, to life-threatening danger.
And Ryan, why was Ernest Brock in jail?
He was charged with downloading or uploading to a server child pornography.
Okay. So one thing I also noticed in your article is that you said the Fresno County Jail doesn't segregate those awaiting trial from those convicted. Is that unusual? And what are the drawbacks?
Well, this is Ryan. It varies. Some counties have facilities that are exclusively for pre-trial detainees. They're kept in entirely different buildings. But if you don't have the, I guess you could call it the luxury of having one facility for sentenced folks and one facility for people who are still going through the process, you have to organize them, or I don't know if you have to. You don't have to do anything, but it's not that uncommon to organize by risk rather than by status. So you put people who have gang affiliations with people who have very similar gang affiliations, so you don't have, you know, inter-gang fights, you know, between the, you know, Southerners and Northerners or Bulldogs. So, it, you know, from one end, it makes sense. From the other end, you know, if sentenced folks are, you know, are an entirely different point in the process than people who are pretrial, you know, and it's not unimportant that people who are pretrial are still innocent in the eyes of the law.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because you also have another person in your story, Lorenzo Herrera. He was 19 years old, and he was put in a gang pod, correct?
That's right. This is Jason.
And so what happened to him?
So what happened to Lorenzo Herrera, who was 19, is during his intake and booking in January 2018 into the Fresno County Jail, he identified himself as a gang member. And during that classification process, as the jail staff is deciding where to house someone, they ask a series of questions, and among those questions is, are you fearful of anybody in this facility? Is there anything that we should know that could potentially jeopardize your safety while you're in our custody? And he said no to that, and he was ultimately housed in a pod for designated Norteño gang members. About two months after he was arrested, about noon on March 24th, 2018, correctional officers who were doing rounds ended up finding him strangled to death in a jail cell on a bunk bed. The mystery surrounding what exactly happened that day continues. The jail does not know, and the sheriff has not identified who or whom is responsible for this death, the murder of Lorenzo Herrera. And to this day, there's active litigation about the case because at this point, it's an unsolved homicide.
So in your reporting, what have you found in terms of why deaths are disproportionate in counties like Fresno? Jason or Paul?
This is Jason. I think that's one of the questions that we're trying to better understand throughout the course of this reporting. What's happened in the years since 2011's realignment is not uniform across California. Some counties are seeing things change in ways that other counties are not. So in the Central Valley, for example, inmate-on-inmate homicides have tripled, and suicides are up about 23% or so. Now, that's obviously alarming for a number of reasons, and a lot of folks have told us that, you know, that's something they definitely want to better understand. But that's not being reflected elsewhere, like in coastal areas. And what our analysis has shown is that, you know, there's a number of factors driving that that might be demographic, but that also have to do with decision making on the part of counties, who are now, by the way, in possession of millions of dollars of taxpayer funds to help deal with this increased responsibility in the aftermath of realignment.
So they could use that money to improve conditions or improve inmates' well-being, but maybe choose to use it otherwise?
Yeah, or choose to, sorry, this is Ryan here, or choose, as some counties have done, to increase programs to basically maintain folks outside of jails, to have alternatives to custody where you're monitoring people or you're helping to encourage them to make their court dates without holding them in cells. That was one of the stated objectives of the realignment, was to reduce the number of people being held, period, across California, which it certainly has done in dramatic ways. But some places, and that's one of the things that appears to be the case, particularly in the Central Valley, in places like Fresno and in Kern, where you have seen, you know, pretty sharp increases in inmate-on-inmate homicides, is they have continued to rely very heavily on incarceration.
So what are they using these millions of dollars for?
Staff salaries, in part, to pay for additional correctional officers or to, you know, to replace correctional officers who are retiring, is one of the big ways they're spending it. In Fresno, They are currently constructing a new jail facility, which is scheduled to be completed, I believe, in a couple of years.
So this is part of a greater reporting expedition, and we look forward to hearing some of your other stories. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Last week, we learned some alarming news about the fungal disease Valley Fever. The caseload in Kern County has been climbing steadily since 2014, and last year, it reached nearly an all-time high. But this happened at the same time as disease research and reporting got a funding boost. Here to give us a Valley Fever update is FM89's healthcare reporter, Carrie Klein. Good morning, Carrie.
Hi, Alice.
So what did we learn from Kern County last week?
Well, the county's Public Health Services Department revealed that nearly 3,000 people there were diagnosed with Valley Fever last year. That's the second highest number of cases ever reported in the county. The highest was in 1992. There was a spike in 2011, then again in 2015, and the numbers have been rising ever since.
And Valley Fever, of course, is a disease that's caught by breathing in fungal spores.
Yeah, that's right. It's caused by a fungus that grows in arid soil in the Southwest, mostly in California, Arizona, and further south in Mexico. It's not transmissible from human to human. Most people recover with no symptoms at all, or it'll seem like maybe they have bronchitis or pneumonia, but really severe cases, which are rare, can spread beyond the lungs and require long-term treatment and really caustic and painful treatment. So we're really concerned with Valley Fever because of the potential to become nasty and really disrupt someone's life.
So why does Kern County matter so much in this bigger picture of Valley Fever?
Well, Kern County is consistently the hardest hit county in California. More than a third of all diagnoses in the state typically are diagnosed in Kern. So that's, of course, kind of scary, but it also means that Valley Fever has become a priority for local lawmakers like Congressman Kevin McCarthy and Assemblymember Rudy Salas. And the county public health department, too, has really made Valley Fever awareness and outreach a big focus.
So in response, the county has increased its outreach and education about the disease, but why does that matter for a disease caused by something out of our control?
Yeah, well, you know, these outreach campaigns really focus on early diagnosis of the disease. You know, health officials want doctors and nurses to have Valley Fever on their radar because treatment appears to be more effective earlier on after the diagnosis. Health officials will also sometimes discourage prolonged outdoor activity on really windy days when there's a higher amount of dust kicked up in the air. So the county has renewed some of its past efforts recently, like PSAs featuring Sheriff Donnie Youngblood running in movie theaters, as well as putting up billboards and social media campaigns and community presentations about the disease.
And why have cases been so high in just the last few years?
So health experts have not totally pinned that down, unfortunately. They believe there's a climate correlation, first of all. And there's a theory that when a rainy year follows a drought, the fungus just grows like gangbusters. And if you recall, that kind of fits with the jump in cases in 2015 when the historically long drought finally ended. But the disease burden has been rising for 4 years since then, and not every year has followed that same, you know, weather trend. So many health officials I spoke with also wonder if maybe the case rate itself isn't increasing, but it's just that the awareness campaigns are working. They think maybe more doctors are diagnosing the disease, and maybe more patients are seeing the doctor when they suspect they have it.
So with all of these new questions, is there new research to help answer them?
Yeah, there is. A lot of institutions have been conducting ongoing Valley Fever disease research for years. Plus, as a part of last year's state budget, outgoing Governor Jerry Brown allocated $2 million of the general fund to outreach throughout the state and $6 million to disease research, split between the University of California system and the Valley Fever Institute, which is a newly created research center at Kern Medical. So here are a couple examples of what's going on. Kern Medical is one of many institutions running a new clinical study to understand more about how the disease behaves. They're analyzing blood samples from people recently diagnosed with the disease. They're also trying to become a hub of Valley Fever diagnosis and treatment, and they've spent some of that money from Governor Brown on educating doctors and expanding their ability to treat patients. Then there's the UC system, which includes, you know, UC Merced. They have a lot of faculty devoted to Valley Fever research, I should say. They have some ongoing research into why the disease could be so much more severe in some people than others. They're also studying how the fungus transforms from living in the soil to living in people's lungs. This is all completely separate from three bills related to Valley Fever that were signed into state law last year, originally introduced by Rudy Salas. One basically codifies using that $2 million for state disease outreach, and the other two laws loosen up the requirements for diagnosing Valley Fever and streamline the process for reporting the disease to the state.
And wasn't there also a high-profile clinical trial happening related to Valley Fever treatment?
There was, and it's been killed. It debuted in 2017 to study one particular treatment for Valley Fever, a drug called fluconazole. The trial was really supported by Congressman Kevin McCarthy, who had helped secure $5 million in funding for the trial. But it was terminated in July of last year. It had aimed to enroll about 1,000 patients, and it only made it to 72. A representative of Kern Medical told me that was the result of some serious design flaws.
Wow. Thanks, Carrie.
Yep, you're welcome.
You've heard of service organizations like the Peace Corps or Teach for America that try to address critical needs in underserved areas. Well, now there's a public service program that tackles the dearth of local news reporting in communities across the country. It's called Report for America. I spoke with the co-founder, Steve Waldman, about why he thinks local journalism is one answer to protecting our democracy. So you came up with the plan for Report for America after authoring a comprehensive report on the state of the U.S. media for the Federal Communications Commission. Did your findings frighten you? Is that kind of why you did this?
Yeah, basically. I mean, this was in 2011, and already, even back then, it was clear that local news was collapsing and that the consequences were really going to be severe in terms of less basic accountability reporting, less coverage of, schools, whether people have clean water, really the key functions of local communities and government were eroding. And most of the attention at that point had been on what was happening with the national media. And there really had not been a sense of what the dire consequences of the collapse of local news were.
So that was the impetus for it. How did you actually put it together and do this?
Well, I teamed up with an existing organization called the Ground Truth Project, which had been around for about 5 years and had done really excellent fellowships with journalists around the world. And we teamed up and started working on this about 2 years ago. And it is loosely modeled after AmeriCorps, Teach for America, City Year, programs like that, in the sense that it's we recruit talented reporters from all over the country, and then we also recruit newsrooms, and we place those great reporters into the newsrooms. And we launched our first class about a year and a half ago, and we just announced another 60 reporters going into the field.
So it's a service, in a sense, to the community. You say that you
yes.
draw on reporters. How do you find these reporters? Are they not working already for newspapers, or are they emerging journalists?
Well, it's interesting. They are emerging journalists. Most of them are working somewhere, but they're often either have strung together a series of internships, or they're working in a job that's not really using their skills, like they might be rewriting instead of reporting.
And is that because there just aren't enough good jobs for journalists?
Exactly. Yeah, it's really that simple. It's that there are very few and shrinking numbers of jobs for local reporters. So a lot of people end up getting jobs at national places like Huffington Post or Politico or things like that, which can be great jobs, but they're not in the communities covering real important beats in the lives of regular families and communities. So these are really appealing beats because they're really set aside to focus on civically important topics, healthcare and education and criminal justice, things like that.
And I read that more than 40% of the core members are journalists of color and 70% are women. One-third of the core members will be reporting in a place they call home. Now, for those who are coming in to a new area for a year, how do you avoid that problem that we all sort of see in journalism of the helicopter journalist who kind of flies in and never really gets to know the community?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, for one thing, it's a minimum of 1 year and hopefully 2 years. Of the first 13 that we had in the field, 11 are doing the second year. So you're making a real commitment. And the other thing that we do is we require the core members, as we call them, to do community service in the community in addition to their reporting. This is a really unusual feature because obviously we believe that local reporting is public service. That's kind of the point of the program. But on top of that, they are doing service projects. And in most cases, it's like working in the local high school or community center, helping teenagers to do kind of youth-created media. And there's a bunch of reasons we do this. We think it's going to be good for the reporter to kind of establish some nuanced understanding of the community from a different angle. It's good for the community to see the reporter in a different way. But it's also just gets them to set down deeper roots and combats a little bit that sense of parachuting in. We want them to really feel like part of the community and that they should view it as their community and that the people in the community should view those reporters as, you know, in some ways their advocates, that they're trying to have their back and look for the issues that are important to the community.
And the selected California core members come from several news outlets, but I noticed that one is a pediatrician who will cover child health in Modesto. Now, how did that come
about? Yeah, I love that one. It's unusual. You know, most of them are more, you know, people with a few years of experience. But we had about a half a dozen that were of a completely different category. They were sort of career changers, people who had done something else in their lives and then later in life had decided to try journalism. And she'd been writing for health journals and things like that as a pediatrician, but she got sort of serious about it a few years ago and went to journalism school and is going to be covering children's health issues in Modesto. So we're thrilled with that. That's a very exciting opportunity for her, and I think also for the community, that you can have someone who's like has a lifetime of experience treating children, writing about children's health care.
Exactly. Tell me about the connection between local journalism and strengthening our democracy.
You just can't have a healthy, functioning community and local democracy without a functioning press. It can be everything. You know, the obvious thing is around voting and elections. You know, it's just the amount of information that most people have, especially about local races in most places, is just pitiful. And we're expected to make decisions about who to vote for based on, you know, almost no information. And there's all sorts of studies, by the way, that lack of local news actually leads to lower voter turnout. So it really is connected on that level, but it's beyond just voting. It's also, you know, basic functioning of the organizations in a community, like the schools. You know, if you don't have a good sense of what's going on in the schools and there's not someone watchdogging it, the schools are not going to get better and you're not going to be able to participate as a parent as easily in the decision-making and the ways of improving schools. And then the last way I would say it hurts democracy is that when you don't have good local media, it actually leads to polarization and people not knowing each other as well. So there's a kind of social disintegration that happens too.
Do you think this is a crisis in America?
I do. I think the crisis in local journalism has become a crisis in democracy. And we really have to get serious about trying to improve local journalism or else it's going to have terrible effects, practical effects of more corruption and, you know, health problems and things like that, but then also sort of problems with the democracy itself working well.
How do you keep a project like this from just being a temporary fix? How do you make sure that it's sustainable?
It's a great question. The model for this program is that we at Report for America pay half of the salary of an entry-level position. The newsroom and the community pay the other half. And what we mean by the community is that we work with the local newsrooms to raise philanthropic money from the community itself. And it can be a local foundation or individual donors, small contributors, some way that the community itself is helping to support this. And that's out of the general belief that community journalism is only going to survive with the support of the community. In the past, that's meant advertising or people buying subscriptions to the newspaper. In the future, it has to be more than that. We are going to have a bigger role for nonprofit news organizations in most communities or places like Report for America. And the community itself is going to have to look at journalism as one of those civic functions that they support.
So this is your second year. So we'll wait to see how Report for America pans out. It'll be interesting in California in particular because there are 8 reporters here, right?
Yeah, there are 8 reporters. One is at the Fresno Bee. A couple are part of a collaborative project with CalMatters around poverty in the state. There's one in Chico covering fire recovery efforts. There's a reporter at the Sun Gazette in San Joaquin Valley focusing on agriculture. So it's a really wide variety of different beats and types of news organizations.
Well, great. Well, Steve, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Take care.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Monica Velez, and reporters Carrie Klein and Laura Satsui.
Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Monica Velez.
And I'm Alice Daniel. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.